HPPodCraft.com.
Hello and welcome to Cape Cod Craft. I'm Chase Winterbottom.
And I'm Topher Van Lackemeister. We're here to talk about yachts and riches.
Riches. And if we get to it, we'll give you the skinny on caviar and how to smoke it.
No.
But first, let's slip into our salt of the earth literary personas, those slobs, Chris Lackey and Chad Pfeiffer, and do comments on HP Podcraft for January, a month of pulp and circumstance.
That's right. This is the comment show for February. And we're starting with Master of Rappling Gate.
Richard Meyer Art writes, "Thanks so much for this one, guys. I thought I had read everything Anne Rice had ever written, except the Jesus novels, so I was delighted to find out there's still one last short story to look forward to. I'm still a little blindsided by her passing. I just always expected another vampire novel was on its way. Lestat versus the Ancient Astronauts, maybe? All joking aside, her work had a huge influence on me in my teens and 20s. She seems to have been a fan of Lovecraft, too, as shown by this section from the beginning of Tale of the Body Thief, where a man approaches Lestat, throws a package at his feet, then flees. I picked up the envelope and saw that it was blank and unsealed. Inside, I found, of all things, a printed short story clipped apparently from a paperback book. It made a small, thick wad of pulp pages stapled together in the upper left-hand corner. No personal note at all. The author of this story was a lovable creature I knew well, H.P. Lovecraft by name, a writer of the supernatural and the macabre. In fact, I knew the story too, and could never forget its title, The Thing on the Doorstep. It had made me laugh, The Thing on the Doorstep. I was smiling now. Yes, I remembered the story, that it was clever, that it had been fun. Anne Rice, Tale of the Body Thief." So Lestat is, conversant with H.P. Lovecraft. I didn't remember that, even though I read that book.
Yeah, of course. And obviously, Thing on the Doorstep ties into Tale of the Body Thief.
Yep. There's some other interesting things in that book that get talked about right here.
Illegal Structures writes, "Thanks for sharing this passage. I read Anne Rice as a teenager before I discovered Lovecraft, so this reference would have been lost on me at the time. Unfortunately, the only thing I remember from Tale of the Body Thief is the extended scene where Lestat urinates for the first time in centuries and gets totally grossed out. Although, maybe that's a false memory? No, I think that's a real memory."
Yeah, I forgot that. I didn't pick up on the Lovecraft thing either, or maybe I did at the time and just don't recall. And I didn't remember until this was mentioned. Oh yeah, there's an Austin Powers like peeing scene.
Richard Meyer Art wrote, "LOL, I don't remember a pissing scene, but the middle of the book is all about Lestat thoroughly screwing up being human again, so it would fit. The last part of the book where David, the head of the Talamasca, takes charge and rescues Lestat is much more enjoyable. There's a heist."
Yeah, I do remember kind of having fun with the book. It just was a brisk 90s thriller.
Sure.
Oh, well, here it says, Illegal Structures responds, "Yes, Body Thief was definitely Anne Rice's attempt to tap into the early 90s popularity of the thriller slash suspense genre. That's what was odd. It didn't seem like one of the Vampire Chronicles anymore. Although many fans consider it an inferior outing compared to the earlier Vampire Chronicles, I enjoyed the pulpy action set pieces. By the way, the scene being referenced is chapter 11. Some choice passages. I unzipped these modern pants." That's just funny enough right there. "I unzipped these modern pants and removed my organ, which immediately astonished me by its limpness and size. The size was fine, of course, but this limpness was repulsive to me. And I didn't want to touch the thing." It gets much more explicit from there, but interested parties can consult pages 171 to 172 of the Ballantine paperback edition for a full accounting. George Orbanks writes, "The only essential vampire books are Interview, Lestat, and Queen of the Damned. First book is a good place to stop if you decide they're not for you." I'd agree with that.
Yeah. Isn't that a thing in the books that the vampires always have boners?
I know that there's some kind of reference to Priapus at the gate or something like that. I don't know if it's always if it's just an at-will thing.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've read those books, and now maybe I should go back. Robbie H. writes, "So, I've been a subscriber for 3 or 4 years now, and I'm up to episode 505. I just realized that you guys have an RSS feed. I was downloading episode by episode until I realized this. Probably not the best place to put this, but just thought I should spend the better part of 2.5 years going to the library. I didn't have internet for the longest time. Downloading 3 to 4 months of episodes at a time and syncing them with my iPod to listen to. Just wanted to let you guys know that you were worth it regardless."
Wow.
I just wanted to put this up here in case anybody else out there is listening doesn't realize that they have an RSS feed. There's one that's free that is only one show a month, but then there's, if you're a Patreon member, then you go to your Patreon page, go to the Posts tab, and under that is an RSS audio feed that is just for you. It's your own personal RSS feed, so nobody else has it, and it's set up to give you whatever content you have for whatever level you have. Definitely get that and use that in the future if you haven't been doing that.
Yeah, unless you prefer the going to the library and downloading 3 to 4 months of episodes at a time. But I really appreciate that effort. That's amazing. We were talking on the show recently about when Heather was on the cruise ship and, you know, internet was spotty out on the water. So they'd come into Seattle or whatever port town it was, and anywhere was suddenly a library, because if they had an internet connection, you'd get in there and it was just like getting those podcasts and those shows and those things was so, you had to do it. You had about a half hour. Let me download what I can. This sugar to keep me company, because once we get back out on the water, I won't have access anymore, or it'll cost a ridiculous amount of money. So I really appreciate the effort. I'm glad that we were one of those things for Robbie.
Andrew Brown writes, I've read a couple of her works, but I was just never moved by her. I found the writing juvenile and derivative, and the whole fascination with pretty vampires strikes me as the same type of wish fulfillment people that writers of sword and sorcery and genre fiction are criticized for, especially in today's world.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, I can see that. If you don't like that experience, I do. I mean, like, wish fulfillment is fine for me.
There's
times I don't want that, and there's times I do.
Sure.
I was thinking about it when I read this. I totally get it if you don't like Anne Rice.
Yeah, of course.
Like, no problem. I have had this problem where there's people will identify, I have a guilty pleasure. For example, Heather will say, oh, Grey's Anatomy, you know, because she still watches it, even though she knows it's not great. But I feel like whenever somebody asks me what mine is, I can't answer, because I'm somehow incapable of experiencing shame when it comes to the things I consume. I just don't feel a shred of guilt about anything I like. At all.
Good. Well, good for you.
Do you have a guilty pleasure?
No, I'm pretty open about it. I didn't used to be. I used to be in the closet about like role-playing games and stuff like that, especially when I was dating. That was something you don't drop until the third or fourth date. That's what you do. Those types of things I did. But
because that might have negative connotations about who you are or...
Or just there is a stereotype around it that I don't think necessarily applies to me, and I don't want people making those assumptions about me.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that they get to know me, these people that I was dating or being friends with. But now that I'm older, I let that stuff fly out right away. I don't care.
Oh, yeah. I think the older you get, just the more honest you are about who you are. In general, although I was glad that you said that, because I wouldn't want to give the impression that, like, I'm too cool for school.
No, no.
That might just be a function of age. But I do think that identity management is important. A lot of times people deride that. They say you should be honest about who you are all the time. There's not dishonesty in maybe putting your best foot forward if you know that there's a way you might be seen. You go, you know what? I want them, as you said, to get to know me first so that that's not an impression I have to fight against or whatever is perfectly fine. Well, you know, I mean, that's just living in society.
Yeah, and you can't tell everybody everything about you at any given time. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's like if you're going, let's say dating, just as a good example. So if I'm on a first date, do you drop the bomb that your dad committed suicide or, you know, whatever horrible thing that happened in your life? Some people feel like, well, I should need to be honest about that right away. And other people don't.
Sure.
I think that's up to
They call it, I can't remember when I studied this, they called it like the onion of self-disclosure.
Yeah.
You know, it's layers. Mm-hmm. And that parental trauma is there in the core.
Sure.
You know, you don't really want to be cutting too deep too quick because it puts people off. They're like, whoa, that's what TMI is, right? Like, that's more than I can handle.
Right. Yeah. And you want to.
Sure.
Yeah. You get that stuff piecemeal.
Yeah.
So it's fine that you don't like this. I would argue with one of your points, though, that I don't think it is just about wish fulfillment. I think there's definitely an aspect to it in that. But there is genuine horror in those books, especially in Interview with a Vampire. Sure. There's a lot of...
And self-repulsion and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff in there that is definitely dark and creepy and...
Certainly, like, Conan isn't sitting around haunted by the judge that he... You know, that skull was cleft in twain. Hurts me to remember it. The ghost of his split face.
Yeah.
No, there's none of that in Conan. Lots of that in Anne Rice. Shayna Carter writes, Interview with the Vampire is one of those books that got passed around in my junior high school, along with Flowers in the Attic. That's perfect. And those Clan of the Cave Bear books.
Right.
I haven't read Anne Rice in a couple of decades, but I recall enough to catch some possible Easter eggs. Rampling is the pseudonym she used for Exit to Eden. Yep.
All right.
While Julie is also the name of the heroine in The Mummy.
Oh, didn't remember that.
One other point, your discussion of vampires deliberately making more versus the all victims rise model reminded me of the 1985 cult classic Life Force,
yes,
in which vampiric aliens are brought to Earth from a comet. Because every victim also becomes a vampire, their numbers double at a terrifying rate, leading to a fairly spectacular climax set in a London overrun by monsters. I would argue, Shayna, that any rate is a terrifying rate when it comes to vampires, victims turning into vampires.
Yeah.
Any rate.
Life Force, that, I always keep thinking that that is a good film for bonus content.
I haven't seen it, so it would be.
Yeah, I think that's we should think about that. Maybe in March. I don't know.
I'm also scared of comets, so maybe maybe that's why I've been avoiding it. Cuts too close to the bone.
Eric Speaker in Digressions writes, I started with the vampire Lestat as well. I'm not sure why. When I was a teen in the 80s, my dad had the whole trilogy. I guess I was just confused. As for Anne Rice's religion, on a statement on her website from 2010, she clarified that she was still committed to Christ, but was giving up on Christianity. Following Christ does not mean following his followers. Fair enough.
That's a smart way to look at it.
Yeah, and that gets us into...
Dr. Satan.
Can't follow Christ into that story, can you? Actually, I guess you can. Of characters, Christ is the number one dude to be hanging out with the devil, really. I mean, they have scenes together in the Bible, right? John Bladeck writes, this story puts the PU in pulp exactly where it belongs. I realize in a recent show you just referenced Mr. Kicks and Dr. Go, but if any show demands a callback to that titan of the genre, Dr. Satan was it. I half expected either Chris or Chad to admit Paul Ernst's series was the inspiration for the admittedly superior Mr. Kicks Dr. Go, and had been waiting for a decade to finally cover it on the show. I understand Satan was not really a doctor, but did play one on TV. I mean, it was. It, when I was reading it, I absolutely was thinking of that.
Oh,
we were
yeah.
making fun of the Shadow and those radio dramas, and that's what this was trying to play with as well. So same source material, but yeah, it was interesting how it was. I mean, you can't parody Dr. Satan. You just do it straight, and it's hilarious. You do it exactly as it's written. It's already funny, so there's not much to make fun of, but that we're exploiting the same source.
Yeah, yeah. Peter Larson writes, I read a bunch of the Avenger novels when they were reprinted in the early 70s. I remember them being entertaining enough for a younger teenager, although the character's main trick was that he could use chemicals to reshape his face to mimic the appearance of anyone. Wow. And he carried around a case of all sorts of disguise elements, like wigs and false eyebrows and a whole lot of dentures. Since he had had his teeth pulled to be a better master of disguise. Ooh, God.
Oof, boy.
This is a terrible plan. Don't do it.
Oh. Okay. Michelle Albert writes, so on a tactical level, I have to disagree that killing somebody with a tree growing out of their head doesn't send as strong a message as killing them with a sudden gout of flame. The flame is impermanent. And if you're left with anything at all, it's a pile of ash. With the tree thing, you got some lasting body horror going there and plenty of space for people to make religious connections with thorns and all. Mm. I wish there was some way for me to make this funny, and I'm sure there is. I just can't think of it right now.
But I got to.
But you make a good point.
You make a great point. I totally agree with you. You've turned me over on this topic.
Yeah.
I think a tree in the skull is much better than about a blue flame.
Michelle did have another comment. Actually, it was in response to the one you read, which was, thank you for telling me that having all my teeth pulled out just so I can be a better master of disguise is a bad idea. I was starting to think about where all my pliers are. So you did save it, Michelle, by having a gem of a funny comment there.
Peter Larson responds to that. I asked my dentist about it once. Apparently, having all your teeth removed weakens the bone structure of your jaw a lot. Or it did 40 years ago. No idea about now. Maybe there's a new technique. So it's a bad decision for a crime fighter who gets into fist fights.
Yeah. Why were you asking about that? So many questions.
Rob Gilley writes, this was just so much fun to listen to, especially after a particularly long and especially stupid day at work. When Chad explained how everything in the story was happening organically, I had to stop the podcast because I was laughing so hard I hurt myself.
That does my heart good. Actually, I think, you know, I watched that, I don't know if it's true or not, I watched that television show Feud that was about Betty Davis and Joan Crawford.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and,
great show.
Joan Crawford had had her teeth pulled to keep that sort of sunken cheek look.
Oh.
That was something common among actresses at the time,
God.
Which was particularly horrifying detail.
Yeah.
About what those women went through. Bryce Perry writes, loved the episode except for the mispronunciation of the word wizened. The first syllable is pronounced like whiz, not like wise. I think I said wizened.
Yeah.
It's a common mistake and one I made as a middle schooler only to have my school teacher aunt ridicule me for the pronunciation. I never hear that spoken out loud, so it's a typical reader's pronunciation. I didn't know if it was wizened or wizened, then I think I'll still probably have a problem with it.
I'm going to say it's regional, that in the Midwest, people say wizened. And not wizened.
Well, there you go.
Prove me wrong.
Eric Speaker in Digressions writes, I was inspired to use Hero Forge to mock up Dr. Satan killing someone with a brain tree. Aha, now we know the sinister reason for the Boston suburb. That's funny. But alas, I cannot post it here for your admiration. Well, We will post it to our social media when we post this episode because it's awesome.
Yeah.
It totally is Dr. Satan killing someone with a tree in the head, which I love.
I follow Eric on Facebook and he posts all these Hero Forge miniature mock-ups that he does. And he's, you know, he does some really cool stuff, really interesting characters that you never would have thought of as a miniature. And he's able to construct them. Really cool stuff.
That gets us into Blood for the Vampire Dead. Penguin Tots writes, early morning strange tales, life is good. That's awesome that somebody had that reaction. That was good for my day to read that.
Yeah. Ben A. writes, I have a colleague who calls people by their first and last names. I always thought it was a weird quirk, but now you guys have made me think that they're really a body-snatching imposter. Guess I'll have to test them to see if they understand modern banking, ATM, machine, have fake hands, or start talking about topics they couldn't possibly know. Lewis Davis writes, big motivation to write everyone's first and second name if you're paid by the word and you're already bored of your story.
Yeah, you know, there actually might be some wisdom there. It would be a way to slightly bump up your check to use everybody's full name. By the way, ATM machine, that's something that folks debate about, isn't it? Because you are saying machine twice. It's in the automated teller machine.
Yeah.
Thomas Painter writes, half Dracula is definitely a D&D third edition racial template.
It is.
Is that true?
Yep.
Really? You can be half a Dracula?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, isn't like the Vampire Hunter D half Dracula as well?
I know Blade is kind of supposed to be half Dracula, right?
Well, yeah. Blade was his mother while she was pregnant with him in the movie. I don't know about the comic books, but in the movie, while she was pregnant with him, she got turned into a vampire. So he was born human,
right?
But, you know, he got vampire blood in him. So he became this half vampire.
Well, if your mother's a Dracula, you're a Dracula. That's, I think, how it goes.
Yeah, sure.
Shuggoth Lord writes, wait, father? Chad, the old guy in Let the Right One In isn't Eli's father. He's a pedophile.
What?
I thought this was an awesome misunderstanding of the year from my... Not misunderstanding. I just didn't remember it right.
Right.
So her companion, it's not her dad. Gavin O'Brien writes, I'm sure someone mentioned it, but Chad, you are remembering Let the Right One In completely wrong. The vampire is a child, but it's a boy who is castrated and lives as a girl, and the father of the vampire is a random pedophile the vampire lets take care of them.
Whoa. I saw the movie and I didn't get any of that from the, maybe it's in the book.
No, it's in the movie, I think.
Owen Elliott writes, man, I really enjoyed that time in the Ozarks.
Yeah, we wound up paying his rent. I mean, it was a really good reading just to bring that to a conclusion. Owen, I'm glad you had a good time. You deserve it. George R. Banks writes, I think Lige is short for Elijah. And I'm sure it is. That's what we were missing about that name. Yeah.
Levi Horn writes, we wear clothes in the Ozarks, unlike Dr. Tim Croft. It's nice to hear a story that takes place here. It certainly presents itself as a perfect setting for gloom and doom. So much untouched land and rich with lore. It's too bad the story was terrible. I'm so frightened.
Comments 45, Nutcracker and Ghosts in the Blood. Professor Koshka writes, thanks for reading out my comment. I'm glad I had something worth contributing. Just wanted to let you know you pronounced my name incorrectly. The O in Koshka is like the O in David Bowie. Type it into Google Translate to hear it. It's Russian. Koshka. I'm not Russian myself, but I used to work somewhere with a lot of Russians and took a liking to the language. I was mispronouncing it as Koshka. Now, I just want to say, I don't like libeling animals, but I'm going to say it on the air here. The cat who steals from me that I've mentioned a few times is named Koshka.
Oh,
so that's what happened there.
Gotcha.
I hear the name a lot and it's pronounced that way.
Wow.
But in this case, our listener, Koshka.
And that gets us into Batman. Paul Maher writes, Chad is definitely a better Batman than George Clooney.
I'll take it.
Pagurus writes, usually I think I know where Chad is quoting directly from the actual story and where he just ad-libs making fun of the narration. This time, I wasn't so sure more than half the time.
It was all from the story, I think, except one time I was talking about nuzzling with my bat baby, and that was not in the story.
Jennifer DeFord writes, I don't know what I expected out of this episode, but it wasn't a touching love story between bats.
No. Broke expectations. That's what's so great about it.
Shane
Robertson writes, the real story here is how the bats of the quarry accepted him over time as one of their own, teaching him their ways, much like Boba Fett and the Tuskens or Tom Cruise and those samurai. This is Dances with Bats.
It is.
Sure is. Rob Gilly writes, I don't know, guys. Wuthering Heights and Frankenstein and Candide were all pretty good books, but I never realized until now that they would have been truly great books if only they'd had a guy who thought he was a bat in them. Agreed.
Yeah. Wuthering Heights would have been so much better.
Yep.
Peter Larson writes, there was an article I read years ago where a journalist, Tim Cahill maybe, was going into a cave with a group of experts, and he made some crack about bats and hair, since there were a lot of bats flying in and out. And the experts stood up and said, look, bats have really good navigation because of sonar, so they don't just fly into people. At that moment, a bat slammed right into his head, and the bat and expert both screamed. The journalist checked in with the bat expert after and was told that since bats' navigation interferes with each other a bit, they don't use it on home ground, they navigate by memory, which I thought is an interesting fact. So when they're in their bat cave, because there's so many bats squawking around, they don't, their sonar doesn't work so great, so they just remember where things are. And if a person's standing there where there wouldn't normally be a person, collision,
that's trouble.
He goes on to say, so the one time a bat might get stuck in your hair would be during a home visit. This is why bats have a reputation of being terrible hosts. Now I know the rest of the story.
Stacy Schumacher writes, in a previous job, I used to take the public on guided bat walks with the little handheld detectors that would play their echolocation sounds back at a frequency we can hear. Bat walks. That just makes me think she's, all right, guys, there's a little bat on the ground there. We're going to walk behind him. Keep your distance. He's limping with this little crutch. Probably going to go visit a strange woman. No, I would always have someone bring up the bats and the hair myth on these guided bat walks. Uh-huh. If a bat can catch a tiny midge or mosquito in midair, why in the world would anyone think they're clumsy enough to fly into hair or have any desire to do so? It's probably because bats swoop around and people have bad spatial awareness, so they think a bat is closer than it is. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I flinch at something. I've flinched at airplanes before, you know, so... That's fine. My favorite information to share with them was given to me by a different staff person, and I wish I could find the source material online, but I can't. Nevertheless, here goes. Apparently, the Victorians, with their scientific curiosity, set out to find which color of women's hair was most likely to attract bats. They put four women, each with a different hair color, blonde, brunette, black, and red, into four rooms with the windows covered up and no source of light. If there's no source of light, how are you going to know which color
exactly.
it is?
Exactly.
Then they put, I guess this is Victorian understanding of the world. Then they put a bat into each of the rooms and timed how long it took for the bat to fly into the woman's hair. And of course, the bats, not being idiots, didn't fly into anyone's hair and just hung out in the corner until the experiment was done. What a great assumption to start, that we know they're going to fly into the hair. They can't stop themselves. Mm-hmm. What color will it be? How fast? That's what we're measuring here today. Manimal, high stakes. Let's talk about that episode.
Yes, Shoggoth Lord writes, wait, Chris is sexually attracted to ghosts?
Was that a revelation in that episode?
I thought that was something people knew. Attracted to some ghosts. Depends on the ghost.
Depends on the ghost. I feel the same way. Jason Thompson writes, man, you guys cut right to one of my greatest pet peeves. I hate sympathetic monster stories. Having monsters as a stand-in for some kind of marginalized group is so played out. Humans eat cows, so it's perfectly moral for this monster to eat humans is such a high school level gotcha. The point of monsters is to be the other, an existential threat like death or loss of individuality or pollution or whatever animal the author has a phobia of. I only dig sympathetic or semi-sympathetic monster stories when the monster is essentially a literalization of some kind of sin or failing, and it's really about experiencing the mindset of a dangerously crazy or evil person, plus tentacles or rotting skin or whatever. Stories of moral weakness and corruption and people being evil to other people are always interesting, and it's cool when some kind of monsterism gives that a fantasy gloss, but pure sympathetic monsters, spare me. Except I'll give a pass to Godzilla. At least he doesn't talk constantly.
Good old Godzilla.
Yeah, he's the most sympathetic monster to me, really.
I love him.
Just grumpy.
And Jason continues, too long didn't read. What I love in horror is the stories that make ordinary things and people scary, not stories that make scary things ordinary. There you go.
Yeah, I could see that.
DR writes, Luke does try pacifism when he refuses to strike down the Emperor at the end of Return of the Jedi. It doesn't work and he gets Force Lightning from the Emperor and has to get his dad, Vader, to sacrifice himself into taking out the Emperor. There's not much of a gray area in Star Wars with evil being so evil that it's wiping out planets and has an empire that wants to take over or destroy everything. So unless someone fights it, then it won't ever stop. Maybe the Force should be taken away from Jedi. I think it's a bad influence on them. Also, if Manimal got a reboot... I love the lane change here. Also, if Manimal got a reboot, should he fight an evil Manimal with them changing into different animals like the shape-changing wizard versus witch fight in the animated film The Sword and the Stone? Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, of course you'd have something like that.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
That would be the last half hour of the damn movie.
Yeah.
I don't think I was articulating myself very well when we were having that Star Wars conversation. There were two things that were interesting. One, I wasn't pushing a worldview on my part.
No.
I just thought that in a thing called Star Wars, there might be some more tension to explore between somebody who rejects the concept of war. It's mentioned, wars make none one great, mm-hmm. in it, but I rarely see anybody actually living that lifestyle. I absolutely understand. They have done, actually, episodes. I think there was one that might have been on the Clone Wars or Rebels where it was a little pacifist town that didn't want to get involved. And then, of course, they got run over and had to get involved in some way, or I don't remember how it exactly played out. It was a crib of a plot from an old samurai thing. They have explored it to an extent, but it's funny. I shouldn't have even been using the word pacifism. I guess I was thinking more of someone who's like a Batman or something like that, who is able to get out of situations less so than when Batman's just beating the pulp out of criminals, but how he'll detain somebody instead of shooting them or killing them.
Right.
What are non-lethal explorations in these sorts of open world war filled worlds? I'm always interested in doctor characters and people who heal, and mm-hmm. that's really interesting to me. Who do you heal and who do you don't? Because revoking care is a form of violence, and those kinds of things are really interesting to me too.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, why aren't there more physicians or anything of that nature as well in Star Wars? So we could talk about it at the end of the episode, but I think I wasn't trying to say Star Wars should be more like Star Trek.
No. And okay. One of the things about the Jedi too is that they don't kill if they don't have to. The lightsaber is a weapon that when they cut somebody's arm off, they'll try to do things like that, which I don't know if is any better, really. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. obviously I prefer to have my arm chopped off than be dead, but the lightsaber is a weapon that cauterizes wounds, so people don't typically bleed out from those things. However, guys like Mace Windu, he just freaking cut Jango Fett's head right off. Just right away. Decapitation. He didn't even try to go for an arm. Yeah, I don't know. Star Wars is pretty inconsistent.
Man. Obi-Wan could have just like Jedi mind tricked that guy. He didn't have to cut his arm off. That was for his pleasure.
Oh, and when Anakin Skywalker, he chops off his arms and legs and then just leaves him there to burn to death.
He's like, you should have listened to me before.
It's pretty brutal.
No room for change. Well, yeah, but I'm fine with that thing. I think that it's the corrupting influence of violence. You have people who go, we're going to be pacifists and we're going to be cool with the balance of the world. And then bad guys show up and go, that's these guys are idiots. Look, we can just roll right over mm-hmm. them. So at some point you take up arms. And then once that happens, it's a reducing thing in human history.
Sure.
That the group that starts with the good ideals in order to take the levers of power has to use violence, mm-hmm. and then that's inherently corrupting because, Mookiebus writes, woo, more Manimals. Sorry the episode wasn't great, but at least your coverage of it was as always. I always love going through old shows and seeing how they did things before we had CGI. They had to get pretty creative a lot of the time. In regards to having a pacifist, it actually sounds like you're describing Doctor Who. Huh. The Doctor never carries a weapon, always tries to find a peaceful solution. It'd actually be pretty awesome to have a character like that in the Star Wars universe. Looking forward to Werewolves next month. And yes, mm-hmm. Mookiebus, that is what I was talking about.
Good point.
I would love it if there was somebody who led with their intellect a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because I watch Star Wars and I go, why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think it would be nice if there was a character who was speaking for me in that regard.
Yeah.
There's a lot of times where I don't, why don't they use a tractor beam and just force somebody over there and leave?
Yeah.
Jim Cannon writes, no pacifists at Star Wars. I see you're one of those people who pretends Last Jedi never happened. Luke does the total Kung Fu Master stuff at the end, dodging every attack, not making any of his own. On another note, I can't believe I'm defending a Star Wars. he wasn't really there.
He wasn't there. So, of course, he couldn't.
So, he couldn't attack. Yeah. That was lame. Overall, I love Star Wars.
Me too.
And I love Manimal. I loved all the pulpy. I mean, Star Wars is pulp.
It is.
You know what I was watching? Amazon just came out with this Jack Reacher show. You know, they did some Tom Cruise movies.
Yes.
One of the big complaints about the Tom Cruise movies is that he wasn't a huge person, because I think in the books he's 6'5 or something like that. It was funny that Tom Cruise did that to an extent. But the show is on, and I guess Amazon's, as with the Jack Ryan stuff, they're just leaning hard into those dad paperback novels from the airport with their series. Mm-hmm. And they execute on it very well. But that is 100% the modern day equivalent of these pulp things.
Oh, yeah.
Jack Reacher is the, I don't understand. This character is so Batman. He's like they have that scene where they go, what do we know about this guy? Well, and then they call up his resume. You know that scene? He saved an infant from a missile, and then they gave him 20 accommodations. They go, he's prosecuted like 110 cases in the military,
what?
All successfully. He didn't fail once.
He's a lawyer?
Yeah, he's some kind of, no, he's like a military cop, but he's not doing that anymore. And he's also like an awesome music fan.
Wow.
And super physically, you could never be in his physical condition unless all you did was work out and work on your diet. But somehow he also has time to be like a master interrogator. And, you know, it's a lot of stuff where he goes, you guys wouldn't mess with me if you knew it was about to happen to you. And they're like, and by the way, this guy is 6'5". Anybody would run away from him. You know?
Yeah.
But lots of guys who are like my size go, you know, why don't you get out of my town, MF-er? I'm going to take you on anyway. And then he goes, well, I guess I'm going to have to break your arm. But I'm watching and I'm like, yeah, look at him. Get that guy. They suggested he was racist and beats his girlfriend. This guy's going to, you watch it, soak it in. It's for that.
Yeah. You want to see fulfillment stuff. Bad people getting their comeuppance.
Yeah.
And that's all those shows are for.
And then the cop in there, who's the girl. 2 seconds ago, she was playing a teenager in the Scream series, and now she's running the police department. And she's like, she's like, Reacher, you came down here and you're breaking all the rules and pushing people around and breaking thumbs and stuff, but you have kind eyes. I see you don't have a motel. Why don't you come stay in my home? He's like, all right, but I won't have sex with you. Oh, man.
I haven't watched it, but now I feel like I must.
It's the most TV brand flavored TV I've ever consumed. It's fantastic. All right, guys, thanks for sticking with us. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to The Comment Show, only on Patreon. HPPodcast.com.